It's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
Whoa, you just blew my mind because nobody talks about that shit.
Like, thank you for this. Like, I was looking forward to this chat, man. I love your interviews.
I thank you for what you're doing. Like, it's excellent. And people can continue to learn the stories of these bedroom Beethovens.
How did you find out about this? Oh my God.
Having something like this to shed light on us is amazing. Like, we really need this documentation. So people like you are definitely needed.
From the 5-7 Collective, welcome to Bedroom Beethovens, the podcast where I sit down with music producers and talk about each phase of their lives and how it's necessary for their evolution and story to unfold. We see things start to build on each other, and the experiences they either embrace or resist that change them internally to be who they needed to be and learn what they needed to learn. This podcast keeps the story moving forward. I'm your host, Cello, my guest this week.
My name is Eli, and I am part of a crew called Living Legends. I'm a part of a group called Three Melancholy Gypsies. I'm part of a group called The Grouchin' Eli. I'm part of a group called Grand Tapestry, and I've produced for a lot for myself, obviously, and my own crew and the people that I work with, but I've also produced for people like John Cena.
I thought John Cena would be a name that you would have left off that list, I swear to God.
Because he could actually rap, and I was very surprised by that song. When we did make it and he sent it to me, I was scared to hear it. And then I was like, oh shit, this dude could actually rap. It was very, very encouraging, man. That guy's actually a good guy.
We chat about 25 years in the game, from the days in Echo Park to Living Legends, getting clean, staying clean, and what lies ahead. But the 10,000-hour journey is what I'd like to highlight with this episode and all the others. The key to realizing a dream is to focus not on success, but significance. And then even the small steps and little victories along your path will take on greater meaning. Remember, as you listen to these conversations with these podcasts that I produce with Eli and myself, this is your journey, your body, your mind, and your spirit. Dig deep, own it, and start doing things for you and by you. Sometimes the people around you won't understand your journey, and they don't need to. It's not for them. Bedroom Beethovens is committed to bringing audio content such as music and stories to more people in more ways. So if you enjoy this podcast, tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best way to help spread awareness of the podcast, and it really supports the efforts that I put forth. Please visit the website, bedroombeethovens.com, and support the show on patreon.com/bedroombeethovens. There are many cool tiers there that include early content, shout-outs from yours truly, merch, and much more. Let's start the show. Well, I heard through the grapevine that you've been having some health issues, and I just wanted to say I'm glad you're feeling like your old self again. And you recently did a show in my home state of Texas, so I hope we treated you well.
Oh yeah, bro, and thank you. And you are correct. It's been a crazy 4 months, bro. Like, it's been one of those moments that happens to me. It seems like I could pick them out in my life, like life-changing moments where something happens that flips everything upside down for you. And in the end, when you pass through this tunnel, you end up a different person after, in a good way, though. I would call it the spiritual growth moments for me, like leveling up And unfortunately, the last couple have come with physical things came with them. So something physical happened that flips my world upside down, that leads me down these trails and these paths that end up taking me inwards. And in the end, I end up walking through some big fear and smashing through it and having this new outlook. And that Houston show that you speak of that I just did was kind of one of those moments where it was a fear-breaking exercise. And it's like, dude, I've been performing for 20 plus years. And how is another show a moment of growth for me when I've been doing it for so many years? And it's just the fact is that performing has always been a challenge for me. Not actually being on stage and being with the people, that's like the most freeing part of it. But everything surrounding shows, the anxiety level, the wanting to be perfect in as far as like not messing up when I'm on stage, wanting to always be on point and like give them the 110%. So like this moment in Houston was just another moment where I've been going through all the stuff that I've been through in the last 4 months, which I won't even get into because that'll take up the whole podcast. But yeah. Very long story short, I had a chiropractic adjustment that ended in vagus nerve trauma. So trauma in the nerve that runs from your neck all the way down to your stomach. It's a huge nerve. It controls your parasympathetic nervous system. And I had a chiropractic adjustment that traumatized it. And it sent me down a huge rabbit hole of vertigo and dizziness and not knowing what was wrong with me. And it was scary. It was very scary. And I'm still going to be recovering for this for a while. Nerve damage, nerve trauma takes a long time. Nerves don't like being messed with. So it might take a year for me to feel all the way back. But I can tell you, the flight to Houston, the actual flight, plus the actual show and all the stress that comes with the show for me, me being able to execute that at a high level and get on a flight home and feel completely relaxed and strong and happy, even at not 100% healthy, that let me know, okay, I'm good. I'm good to go. I can do my thing at a high level and not even, it doesn't matter if I'm 100% yet. I don't need to be to do this. So it was huge. It was a huge trip for me, man.
Well, like you, I'm very heavily tattooed. I have both my arms tattooed, and the person who tattoos me has been doing it for 30 plus years. And he's telling me just the way that he has been sitting tattooing for years and years and years, he was getting nerve damage too. And is that something that was brought on by performing on stage or your hectic schedule? Is that a side effect?
No, dude. I think what happened was probably sort of a domino effect of a bunch of things falling down right at the same time. Perfect storm, quote unquote. And I don't believe in coincidence, dude, honestly. Like, these things happen for a reason to me. And but the actual moment that caused this was the chiropractic adjustment, the way I was adjusted and the adjustment itself. Literally, bro, I've been having the same adjustment done for 9 years with the same guy. And that day, he did this neck adjustment. And right when he did it, I literally said, whoa. And he was like, it was a weird adjustment. It didn't feel right. And that was the catalyst. But stress in general and the way that I've been dealing with stress relating to just the way I am, plus performing, and everything that comes along with that for me. Yes, I believe it is a part of the trauma that I experienced. It wasn't just the adjustment, although that was like the physical catalyst. But yeah.
Where you come from in Echo Park, you come from like a great alumni of performers, actors, and musicians like Leonardo DiCaprio, Frank Zappa, Steve McQueen, Charlie Chaplin, Lana Del Rey, Danny Trejo. They all came from where you came from.
Oh, Danny, that's awesome that you came with a list like that. That's really cool.
And, you know, it's funny, like now it's like I read up a tiny bit on the area and Latinos still form the majority of the community.
Yes.
Though the percentage fell from 70% in 2000 to 60% in 2010, and whites grew from 13% the 23 in that same time frame. Yeah. So whatever image you have of Echo Park growing up, it seems it's moving towards gentrification. Maybe next time you go there, there's probably going to be some Whole Foods and Trader Joe's. I don't know.
Oh, bro, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, telling them, oh, I grew up in Echo Park. And they're like, oh, really? So nice. I'm like, yeah, now it is. But at the same time, you drive around into some of the neighborhoods over there, and it's still some shit going down over there, but it is super gentrified, bro. Sunset is a completely different world down where you turn up to go into my neighborhood. There's just so many, honestly, amazing places to eat down there now, and there's so many white people everywhere. It's a weird sight. I'm kind of used to it now because it's been happening. The gentrification has been happening for 15 years, a long time, maybe longer. But when I was there, it was the 80s, and it was all Latino and Filipino neighborhood and gangs. And the gangs were crazy in the 80s over there. And so it was a totally different vibe. But I still love Echo Park. And honestly, if I could afford it, I'd probably live over there still. You know, gentrification is it's such a two-sided thing, because people getting forced from their homes is horrible. I hate that. And I hate the culture being stripped from places like Echo Park and Oakland and other places like that. But at the same time, you look and you see all these amazing restaurants and shops and the mixing up of people, which I actually love and always loved living where people were all mixed up. I love that part, but it's just not fair. You know what I mean? So I have two-sided feelings on gentrification for sure.
Well, back then, like, let's just say when your mom kicked you out of the house and you dropped out of school, now you're living with your crew. Did you have scared doubts like, man, this shit better work out or else everything my mom said is going to come true, or I'm going to be 30 years old working at Boston Market giving people mashed potatoes?
Boston Market, why'd you pick that place of all places? You know, what's cool is I never had any doubts. And I don't think it was because I was so confident. It was more because I wasn't thinking about the future, man. And what's scary is I'm sort of still like that. I've always looked at what's in front of me and kind of like rolled with the tide. And you know, being a Pisces, being a triple water sign, you know, I don't mean to take you to the horoscopes, but I have always been kind of a go with the flow dude and go where the river takes me. And that's why I married a woman who is an earth sign, grounded, very meticulous, a planner, scheduler type of person. So we balance each other.
Yeah, we're flipped. I'm a triple bull. I'm a Taurus and a bull, and I forgot what the third one is.
What's funny is, you know, Grouch is a Taurus, and I've always clicked with you guys, like, because we just kind of balance each other out the same way. And Grouch is definitely more of a business minded guy, and I am the guy that's like, I don't want to deal with none of that shit. Somebody else do this stuff for me. I don't want to book my own shows. I don't want to talk about money. I don't want to do none of that. I want to do the art. That's what I want to do. But being coming from where I've come from and, you know, from making our own tapes and drawing my own covers and having to sell myself, I've learned what I needed to learn in order to survive on my own, because I've never had a team, dude. And it really has kind of held me back, I think, as far as quote unquote how big I could have got, how big I could have become, or whatever it may be. I feel as though having a team would have helped me be bigger, have more exposure, have more fans, you know, like, but I've never had that. And I don't want to sit here and complain about it. It just didn't work out that way. But I say all that to say that even though I don't enjoy the business, I don't enjoy talking about money and negotiating and all that crap, I have to do it because that's what you have to do when you have no team. You need to learn. You need to know how to do it. You need to be willing to do it.
On that bittersweet note, I can give you a pretty good story that relates to you and it relates to me. If you don't mind, would you indulge me?
Yeah, of course.
So one of your songs really actually helped my marriage back in 2016. It's a true story. I was working at IBM in 2016, and it was a job that entailed 100% travel. So I had to travel the country, and I had to spend like 14-hour days in New York pitching deals and winning business deals for our team's portfolio. And I left home. My wife and I must have had a disagreement or something. I don't actually remember, but morale wasn't the highest. And then coupled with that, I left her at home with two young kids, so I couldn't help out.
Oh my God.
I'm in the middle of this trip. I'm at the airport, and I got some time to kill before I board my plane. So I'm sitting at the gate, and I shuffle through my playlist, and I put on some music. And Love of My Life from your album Grey Crow came on. Now, I get the metaphor where music's kind of the main chick, but when Lucky rhymes, I'm always gone, you probably want a better man. Like, I rewound that song, and I listened to the song very intently, and then I sent the song to my wife with a note saying, thinking of you, listen to the lyrics. And she texted me back, saying, I don't want anyone else, just you. And man, songs can, like, they can really heal, man. I just wanted to let you know in that moment, your song provided assurance and let me know that what I was doing for my family was the right thing.
Wow, that's great. I love that.
Yeah, so even though you don't have, you know, a team and you got to deal with all that BS sometimes, like, you never know how your music is affecting somebody.
And I love those stories, man. I mean, you know, it's funny how people will tell me, I'm sure you hear this all the time, but I'm like, I'm sure you're tired of hearing this, but I'm like, do you think I'm ever tired of hearing stories like this and people saying how I've, you know, my music kind of pushed them or helped them get clean or whatever the thing is? It's like, all that's important to me, man. It makes me feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So thank you.
Do you know how Lucky got his name?
Lucky I am. I actually do not.
Well, it's not very poetic, but him and his uncle were at a B-boy festival, and he said that it was like a sausage party, and he pulled like the only girl there, and his uncle said, damn, you lucky, and he was like, lucky I am. So, yeah, very, very poetic.
Yeah, that's a hell of a story there. I think I probably knew that, but that's funny.
Yeah. And, you know, and that whole story does have a point. Like, I know that you offer handwritten lyrics. So, like, you know, whenever I scrounge up some bills, that would probably be my pick.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Of course, dude. Yeah, holler at me when you're ready for that.
So why is Bruce Springsteen Born to Run so special of an album for you?
Man, dude, that's such a good question.
Now, 1 + 1 = 2. That happens every day. That is not magic. That's the grind. It's when you get up, one, go to work, one, go to bed. Two geniuses, two. But when 1 + 1 = 3, that's when your life changes. You see everything new. And these are days when you are visited by visions. When the world around you brings down the spirit and you feel blessed to be alive.
It was, I'm trying to think about how old I was. I was probably three or four. And my mom bought me a Fisher-Price turntable, which was so tight. I can't believe kids had turntables back then. And the first record she bought me was Bruce Springsteen, Born to Run. Why did she buy that for me? Because every time she played it, I would go crazy. As a three-year-old, I'd get up and start dancing and jumping around and, like, loving Bruce, right? So she's like, well, I got to buy him Born to Run. So literally that was the first album that was mine, you know, that was given to me. And it just, every time I listen to it, it's like an old blanket that you hold on to that you're just like, ah, this feels like familiar. It feels so nostalgic to me. His voice, that album, not, you know, that album would be number one, but then so many of his albums kind of resonate with me on a deeper level. And it's because of that time when I bonded with his music, the way he writes, the way he sings. You know, I think for many people, it would be a strange thing to hear that I was such a big Bruce Springsteen fan, because the only other rapper I know that shares my affinity for Bruce is Slug. And he and I have talked about it over the years, like talking about our favorite Bruce albums. But he's literally the only other rapper probably that exists.
you played around the idea of sampling any of his music?
Oh, yeah. I made a couple of beats sampling Bruce. I sold one of them to, you know, because I sell beats to people, and somebody bought one and it was pretty dope. I can't remember which song I sampled. Actually, there's another one that I made a beat from that Grouch and I were playing around with writing to, so we might still do it, which I hope we do because I really like that one. But he just carries a vibe, man. Are you a Bruce fan at all?
I'm not, but you know what? Like, hip hop sampling always ventures me down a road that sometimes I never like realize. So I got another story for you. And I remember going to the movies and I saw a trailer for this Matt Damon movie called Downsizing. I don't know if you know that. It's where he gets shrunk down and lives in a tiny
neighborhood. Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I know the movie.
Well, if you've seen the trailer, Talking Heads Once in a Lifetime plays. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, Eli used that on Find Yourself.
Yep.
You know, so I make little connections like that sometimes.
Yeah.
So like if I hear this beat and I'm like, man, where did that sample come from? Oh, it's Bruce Springsteen. Oh, wow. He's got 30 albums out. Yeah. I can dive in.
And he does. He has 30 albums out. For sure.
And that's kind of what hip hop does for me. Now, the first beat that you and Grouch did, I think you lost it, but you can still recall the melody and like how to reconstruct it. Have you ever thought about maybe for your Patreon or maybe like a little Easter egg, you would kind of, I don't know, from memory, try to recreate that first beat?
First beat or first song?
I just know that one of the early works of you and Grouch, you don't have it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. That would be the first song we ever made together. And I remember the chorus is what I remembered, and I can't remember the beat. I knew that I know that I liked that song a lot, and I wish it existed somewhere because I'd love to hear it. But I'll never forget the day we made that song, and it was literally the first day I met him or hung out with him. It's that doesn't really happen anymore. Like first day you meet somebody. You know, you're in the studio and you're making a beat and you're making a song. Like, what? And I remember the first time Grouch met me, he was kind of like, who is this kid? Who is this weird, dreadheaded kid? And I don't know if I want to hang out with him. So he actually pawned me off to another friend who was weird. He was another weird rapper at that time who he was, trust me, he was a weird dude, like very eclectic. And I remember Grouch like basically said, hey, hang out with Axiom. And I went and I was like, all right. And I went and hung out with Axiom. I'm like, why'd you make me hang out with that?
Yeah.
And then after that, we made that song. And then it was kind of like, all right, we liked each other. And I kept coming over to his house like a stray cat, bro. I was like, once you let me come over and learn how to use this ASR-10 sampler, I'm like, I'm coming. I'm coming back.
The rest is history.
Yeah, the rest is history. Next thing you know, I'm living in his mom's basement with him. And he couldn't get rid of me after that.
Hey, that's dope. Yeah. Man, I couldn't continue this interview either more like a conversation. But I have to congratulate you on 14 years clean, man. I think that's a big feat.
Thank you so much, man.
Before recovery, were you a hard person to be around professionally?
No. I wasn't because what I used and who I am didn't really change. That's why it came to a shock. I mean, so many of my friends were shocked that I was using dope because they had no idea. Because I just was the same guy. You know what I'm saying?
Were you ashamed of the habit and that's why most people didn't know? Like you would do it in private or do it like not around them?
Towards the end, I was taking so many pills and then moved over to heroin itself. And yeah, I didn't want anybody knowing what I was doing because they would fucking want to choke me and be like, what are you fucking doing?
Yeah.
So, I think so. I think shame is a part of that. I didn't want people to know.
I recall Grouch saying that Living Legends didn't always get along. I know MERS quit. Grouch didn't want to do Rock the Bells, even though everyone else wanted to. So you guys ended up passing on it. But then you and Grouch and Zion and I ended up doing the show. And I think some of the other members felt betrayed. And I wanted to know what your perspective on that is, because it must be dope to have, you know, 8 or 9 of the dopest people in a group. But the downside is you have 8 or 9 egos in the room. And I imagine it gets harder to manage.
Yeah, being in a group is not easy, especially when you're all brothers and at one point all live together and everybody, literally everybody in the group has had a fist fight except for me. Like, I've literally never gotten a fight physically with anybody in the group. I could pick out everyone else fighting each other. There's been people knocked out cold, left in the alley after a show. There's been fucking wrestling in the tour bus, knocking shit over, breaking shit. There, just so many fights over the year. And we're talking years ago, bro. Like, no one has fought like that in years. Like, everybody's grown now. Like, nobody has any reason to be fist fighting anymore.
And I think that's a testament to, like, Grouch and Murs hooking up. It's like, we're grown now. It's 20 years later. Maybe we butted heads in the past, but time goes on.
Exactly. I mean, perfect example. They just dropped an album today. It's dope. I got to make a beat on it. They're going on tour together. It's just like people grow up, have kids, have families, and say, hey, let's make an album. And I think it's great. I love it. I love that they're making an album, that they made an album, and that they're doing this tour. It's fucking awesome. But as with any big crew of brothers or people that know each other and have been around each other for a long time, certain people have certain issues with certain people. I mean, it's just unresolved shit that may never be resolved, or, you know, certain people grow, certain people don't grow much or grow in different directions. It's just natural, man. I mean, our circles of friends change as we get older, and, you know, people that we were once inseparable from and spent every day with are no longer in our lives like that. But the thing about Living Legends and everybody in the crew, I don't talk to these guys a lot. I don't see them a lot, except Grouch. And I talk to Scarab and I talk to Murs. Everybody else I don't really talk to often. But when I see them, it's literally, they're my brothers. And it's just like, no love lost at all. Like,
I don't want to downplay the growth, though. You say it's natural, but there's a lot of rappers. There's a lot of people that have Peter Pan syndrome and they don't grow up. Like, what I like about you guys is, like, 20 years ago, I don't think something like Grand Tapestry would have ever happened. I think you had to get to a certain place in life to, like, fully take advantage of that opportunity.
Yes. And it's something about me that anyone that's followed me probably would see easily, is that I am all about collaboration. I'm all about doing something that no one's done before. I'm all about exploring, and otherwise I get bored. I straight would get bored. I don't want to keep making the same album over and over. That's not ever going to be me. And you're right. Like, I had to go through what I went through and be the age I was at to meet Alam, who's the Sarod player in Grand Tapestry, who's, Alam and I write everything. We produce everything on that album. It's he and I. And I would have never been doing that at 20. I didn't have enough to say. Like, Grand Tapestry is a whole nother level. And although I really love the first album, the second album that we have, like, 15 songs recorded, bro. And we haven't even started editing, really sequencing yet. Like, we got a lot of work to do, but the shit is mind blowing to me. This music that we made, I'm just like, oh, I have such a huge vision for Grand Tapestry, and that can reach global audiences and in a whole different way. But, you know, the grand vision takes grand money, and it, you know, Alam and I get frustrated because we're like, how are we going to make this happen? But we're really stuck on it. We really want it. So we'll see what happens. But you're right, man. Without the growth and without the spiritual challenges and everything that I've been through in the last 15 years, I mean, I wouldn't be making the music I am right now.
Are purists like, oh man, you can't use a tabla in rap music. What are you doing?
Oh, man. There's always going to be people hating on everything you do. It's just inevitable. And when Grand Tapestry came out, some people were like, oh my God, what is this? This is amazing. Some people, it took a year for them to be like, dude, I didn't know what to think at first, but now I'm like, this is my favorite album ever. And then you have the random guy on YouTube that says, what the fuck is this? Like, just the most spiteful, ignorant, like, negative comments. And those are the people I don't even like, yeah, respond to at all. I've learned my lesson responding to negativity. They want you to respond. They want to get your they want your energy. They want you to like focus in on them. And I won't do that. If you don't get it, you don't get it. It's fine. I don't expect everyone to love these albums like Grand Tapestry. I mean, it's what's cool is the first tour we did as Grand Tapestry was on the Grouch Stole Christmas tour, and we were in front of our regular underground hip hop crowd, and they knew who I was, so they gave me the space to show them what I was doing, right? They weren't going to boo me off. They weren't going to, you know, yell at me. They were going to say, all right, this is Eli. Let's see what he's doing. And their faces, bro, were just priceless. Like those first shows we were going, we didn't know what to expect. They didn't know what the hell was happening. They're staring. And then I got nervous. But at the end of the song, it was just like cheering, clapping, like, whoa, what? They're staring at the instruments. They're like, what is this? It was just like blowing people's minds. They were like completely intrigued by it.
There's two of us, one of us gotta go, one of us gotta die. Angel and devil on the collarbone, fighting over one mind. Writing on the wall, the mighty will fall. Tidal waves are the vital signs of a man in the final days. Monotone, God's voice is bass. Devil is trebling, trouble is ringing in the ear like rape. Whistling in the dark, no one to hear. Fear is a great dominator, dominating, intimidating, inseminating pain in the brain, penetrating through the vein. Needle and the ketamine and cocaine turn a man numb. This round devil has won, perched on a mound of bones. Tossing flesh at the sun, glossing teeth with belief that he took and replaced with grief.
Still, there's no one like this. And the music that we made for the second album is just, it sounds like an opera, bro. It sounds like it should be performed in an opera house at the Disney Hall with projection mapping, a full orchestra pit, dance, ballet dancing. Like, it should be everything.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is the huge view that I see of it. I want people to be in the crowd to be so overwhelmed with emotion that they're in tears and don't understand why. That is my goal for Grand Tapestry and this new music. And we're aiming at really high caliber choreographers and people that do stuff like this. But it's going to take a couple million dollars to make it for real.
Well, you did a Kickstarter for a triple release 5 years ago. Was that crowdfunding process? Did you walk away like, yeah, this is the future of releasing albums and self-funding? Or was it just a nightmare, like the logistics part of it?
I've had the opportunity to do that again. And actually, Alam, Grand Tapestry, he brought it up for our first album. He's like, maybe we should do a Kickstarter. And I was like really against it because it's very stressful and it's very like push, 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 smash, smash, smash. And if it doesn't work the way we want it, it's just kind of like, wah, wah, you know. And Grouch and I just happened to do it at the right time. But we had to pay the person who helped us organize it and really, you know, get it to come to life and fruition the way we envisioned it. And then we had to personally make sure everything was sent out and handled the way it was supposed to be. It's just a lot of work, dude. A lot of work. Where applying for a grant is like filling out paperwork and like, you know, presenting ourselves as something that deserves this money. But it's not the same as a Kickstarter. Kickstarter's great. I think it works. But I wouldn't use it unless it was like break glass in case of emergency.
Yeah, I totally get that. Sign of the times. Well, excuse my naivete, but do we celebrate 14 years of sobriety because the demon is always lurking? Like once you say you're like 3 years clean, like that's a long time. That's over 1,000 days. Do you still get that itch? Is the demon still kind of breathing on the back of your neck?
No. I was freed from feeling any kind of urge like that after about probably 6 months clean, you know? But if there's any kind of thought that enters my mind occasionally, it's like, oh yeah, I wish I could like hit the weed on the weekend and just chill, have one cigarette after dinner with a shot like that. But that doesn't exist for me, bro. Like I am not that dude. You know how I know? Like even clean, my wife is a tremendous vegan cook and baker, and she will make cookies and give me one. And then I can't stop, dude. I'm like 12 cookies later, my stomach hurts. And I'm like, oh, why did I do that? It's like, dude, because I'm an addict, man. Being an addict, you are always an addict. There is no, I'm cured. I used to be an addict. No, not, that's not how it works, dude. The way my brain works is different from other people's. Once you hit the button, it's hard to turn it off. So there is no one drink, one cigarette, one hit of anything for me. And it's just about knowing myself and knowing that if it's been 14 years, yeah, but if I take a painkiller, I'm fucking in trouble. I'm in big trouble, you know? So it's a fine line, bro. Like, I've seen people with 20 plus years be gone in an instant because they had surgery and they were given painkillers and they didn't hand them off to their spouse or their sponsor. And they decided, oh, I'm strong enough to do this myself. And they end up taking them past when they need them or taking three instead of one. And then next thing you know, you're out, you're gone. Like, and it's scary, dude. So like, you just got to be aware. And taking a cake and celebrating 14 years is a huge accomplishment. And it's just a reminder that I am no different from the person with one day.
Yeah, you told that story of the guy with 20 years of sobriety on your last album. And I heard that. And I was like, man, that's just heartbreaking. Because it's like you can get the dope out of your blood, but you can't get the dope out of your brain. You know, that's a Charlie Parker quote.
And then the dope in your brain is really the way your brain works. The way it fires, the way it reacts to drugs and alcohol and sugar and sex and shopping and gambling and anything that brings you some sort of rush, are the way our brains fixate on those things are different than other people. Other people can do it once and be like, that was fun. And then for a month, not do shit. And they say, you know what? I want to have a drink today. It's like, dude, I envy those people. I'm not going to lie. I wish I could smoke cigarettes, dude. I like smoking. But I quit cigarettes. It's been 8 years now. And to be honest, cigarettes was harder than heroin to quit.
They say heroin is the only drug that doesn't fuck up your organs. Like, it doesn't mess with your liver, which is why like Keith Richards is still alive. As long as you don't OD, you won't do any long-term damage to your body. So I always feel like that's even worse.
Yeah. And I never shot it up. I was always like snorting it, smoking it. But I would have, if I would have kept down the line, I would have ended up shooting it up. That's just what happens. It's the disease is progressive. You keep crossing lines and boundaries where you say to yourself, oh, I'm not as bad as that guy over there smoking crack, but you end up past that guy and you say, oh, well, at least I'm not homeless like that guy. And then you get there. At least I'm not living in a box and I'm in a shelter. It's like, dude, how far can you go? You know?
And is there like a drug dealer to the stars? Because you and Evidence had the same one.
Yeah. He was just a kid. Raindrops falling on my window. Roaming certain circles, and he had the best weed, and you know, yeah, that's funny. You know that story. Raindrops falling on my window. You know, Ev never did drugs. He's just always a weed guy. And yeah, weed is a drug. And people get mad at me when I say, you know, weed is a drug too, man. They're like, what are you talking about? It's medicine. I'm like, all right, dude, sure. Yeah. I applaud everyone who just smokes weed and doesn't have a problem with it. Good for you. I wish I could do the same. But anything in excess, anything that changes the way you're seeing the world is a drug. I'm sorry. Thankfully, amazing story is that guy. The drug dealer guy is now, he just celebrated 12 years clean and he is traveling the world, doing conferences on addiction and food. And he's doing really amazing things himself.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you for educating me on that and my listeners, and congratulations on being clean yesterday, today, and hopefully tomorrow, man. Well, you touched on this at the beginning of our conversation. You've been independent, and you've been independent even before it was cool. Is it still cool to be independent? Is the Little Nas X way of putting a song out on SoundCloud and getting a major deal still not the coolest? Or do people want to drive the ship themselves more these days?
Bro, I don't even know the difference anymore. There's like, I was just talking to Grouch about this. He went to a big festival in Las Vegas, and his daughter, who loves music, went with him, and you know, they were there the whole weekend, and there's barely any lines drawn between genres anymore. There's really no line drawn between somebody who's independent, somebody who's signed. You just can't tell anymore. And so I don't think it freaking matters, to be honest. And I could sit here and say, I'm truly independent, bro. Like, I do this Like, I literally have no team. It's just me. All these other people are frauds saying they're, but who cares, man? Who fucking cares? Like, yeah, sometimes it bugs me if somebody says truly independent and you know that they have a label backing them or they have a big ass team of people, you know, pushing, being the engine behind them when I have none of that. But I'm not gonna, it really doesn't matter to me. I don't think it matters anymore. Genres don't matter anymore. It's just a big freaking melting pot.
What about some solo stuff? Is there anything that you want to tell the people about? I know is it getting ready to be mixed?
I have two solo albums, bro, that one of them is done, mixed, mastered, album cover's done. First video is about 80% shot, but it there was a big pause put on it because of all my health issues. But now we're about to finish that video. And that's an album with my boy DJ Fresh, who has been really taken off lately, and his production is really blowing up and people are all over DJ Fresh, which is great because he deserves it. And he's a huge grinder and is a producer extraordinaire. That album that I have with DJ Fresh is really special. It's really dope, dude. I'm really excited about that one. I think we're going to release it around March. So that's going to happen. Then I have another solo album produced by this dude out of Norway, I believe. His name is Essie. And I was connected with Essie through a friend of mine, Jesse, who runs a label out of Kauai. And he puts out a lot of really positive, angled, kind of boom bappish, you know, it's just like a certain style of hip hop, right? And he asked me to put out an album on his label last year. And I'm like, you know, I really like this dude personally. And I like what he's doing. And I said, all right, dude, I'm with it. And he says, I want to pair you with this guy, Essie, who I'd never heard of. And I said, cool, send me some beats. And he sent me a big ass folder. And I started writing immediately. I was really inspired by this dude's beats. And the reason why this album is so different for me is anyone who's listened to me for a while, including you, would know that I've definitely not done a lot of songs over boom bappish beats. Like, we're talking like East Coast style, like Premier, Ninth Wonder-esque kind of chopped up samples and loops, and it's a very specific sound. And I haven't done a ton over those kind of beats. Now I have a full album over those beats. And my flow is very slowed down on this. I don't think it was intentional, but I wanted to play with slowing down. I want people to hear what I'm saying. I want people to actually be able to maybe sing my lyrics with me at a show for once, instead of pretending to chop with me and really not knowing what I'm saying and mouthing the wrong words while I'm rapping and me laughing at you because you're doing that. Instead of that, I'd rather have people actually really dive into my words. So this album is very unique for me, very special. And I played a lot of it for Grouch, and Grouch said to me, he's like, bro, don't get mad at me, but I think this might be people's favorite album of yours. And I'm like, why would I be mad, dude? He said that because it's not the usual me. You know, it's not my beats. It's some boom bappish shit. And I agree with him. I was like, dude, I agree. I think people are going to really dig this. And I'm truly excited about that album. So that's two solo albums produced by other producers. And then you got Grand Tapestry.
But do you know how amazing that is? That when you first started out, like as a teenager, you never had to ask anybody, would you like fries with that? And then being in the game for 25 years, people are saying that you're releasing some of your best work. That's a blessing, man.
And I feel the same way. And sometimes, you know, you always got the heads that are like, I liked your shit, you know, as they passed, you know, 96, 99. I'm like, all right, well, that's cool. Thank you. But I'm not the same guy I was back then. And I couldn't write a rap like I did in 96 if I tried, dude. It's just not possible. I wrote differently. I was in a different space. I was a totally different guy. So at this point, what I'm writing now is, it's just, it feels like my best, most solid work. And I hope I continue to feel that way. But so you got those three, and then you have Grouch and Eli album, which we have about 11 songs probably. And that was put on pause because of my health stuff that I had going on. But also they needed to start working on the Merce and Grouch album. So it all worked out. But Grouch and I are going to get back to work on that. And there is a ton of good songs that we have. So, dude, 2020 is a big year for me. I plan to just saturate the market, really get on the road and do a lot of shows and just, you know, be gung-ho. After really going what I've gone through for the last 4 months, I'm like, let me loose. Let me back out there. I need to connect with my people, do some really intimate small shows and maybe some big festivals. Who knows what's going to happen? And I don't know what's going to happen with Grand Tapestry, but I have a big, big wish list, you know?
That's awesome, man. And I want to stress the last piece of the puzzle is your Patreon. I'm 40 plus episodes deep and I got 2 Patreons. I get great downloads. I have thousands of people that listen to me, but getting Patreons is hard because I think people know that I'll keep releasing episodes, but getting support, like people that buy into what you're doing, like you're independent. I don't have to tell you, but when you get fans that buy into what you do, whether it's buying a ticket to your show or a vinyl, or they sign up for your Patreon, those are the fans that really stick. Those are the ones that are really important. So I know how hard it is to grow that thing. So I want to let people know that Eli takes very great care in building his Patreon. That's patreon.com/Eli. And this is just a personal note. Please check it out. Like, check it out, because if you're listening to this podcast, he has a $500 tier where he will make a beat for you, which that should be it. But there's like 60 other things that come from it, like merch and art and song lyrics, Patreon exclusive song. If he's playing a show, you're on the guest list. You get handwritten lyric piece. In my eyes, that's super generous. And the cherry on top, because here's what I would do. If I was an up-and-coming rapper and I'm listening to this podcast, work double shifts at Old Navy, fold some extra shirts, save up $500 a month, be a Patreon for a year, and you would literally have an original body of work that you can put out that is like exclusively produced by Eli for only like $6,000. Come on.
That's a good freaking.
In a previous episode, a guest and I were bugging out on what rappers charge per guest verse, and I think we talked about B.O.B. charging $30,000 for a verse. So you can get a B.O.B. verse, or you can get 5 albums worth of beats from Eli. So please, please join his Patreon, because he's dumb and he severely undervalues his tiers, but it's amazing. So go take advantage of that. I'm a big supporter. I'm going to sign up myself. And I think what you're doing is great, man.
Thanks, bro. I appreciate it, man. I hope you do sign up, and thank you for shouting it out for me.
Yeah, and it's very important that we give you your flowers, because like you said, in 2020, not only is he going to be releasing all these great things, but he's going to be in the music thing for 25 years. So name your favorite MC, check out their wiki to see if they've been this big for 25 years. I bet you they haven't, and it's a feat that shouldn't be minimalized. So, Brother Eli, I can't thank you enough, man, for your art, your love of the game. I'm glad your health is up. I'm glad that your spirits are high. I feel like I'm catching you at one of your best moments in life. So thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, brother. Thank you for having me, man.